Hi, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show, the show for animal training and behavior nerds, where I, Ryan Cartledge, interview the world's most proficient animal training and behavior geeks. We're absolutely thrilled and grateful to have you here with us today. So make sure you hit that subscribe button on whatever you're listening to this on so that you don't miss a single episode. Each episode of this show is brought to you on behalf of the ATA membership. And if you like the conversations in this episode, then you're invited to continue them with like-minded behavior nerds within the membership area, which you can find out more about at www.animaltrainingacademy.com. You'll get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalog of previous web class replays, plus a huge library of videos and projects to help problem solve your training challenges. Plus, we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group and forum areas. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behavior geeks. But we will get started on today's episode where we'll be talking to one Amy Cook. Dr. Cook is an International Association of Animal Behavior Consultants certified dog behavior consultant, a long-standing professional member of the Association of Professional Dog Trainers, the APDT, and was one of the first trainers nationally to become a certified professional dog trainer through independent evaluation. Dr. Cook received her PhD in psychology from UC Berkeley, with her research focusing on the dog-human relationship and its effects on the problem-solving strategies dogs employ. Dr. Cook is the founder and creator of The Playway and a popular instructor for the online school, the Fenzi Dog Sports Academy. She has been training dogs for nearly 30 years and has specialized in the rehabilitation of shy and fearful dogs for 20 of those. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome Amy Cook to the show today, who is patiently waiting by in California, USA. Amy, thank you so much for taking the time to come and hang out with us at Animal Training Academy.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be here. Here from sunny, beautiful California. I know that many people across the world right now have the cold weather, but I'm sitting here in a sunspot, so no better time to have such a space to have a conversation with you about something I'm really passionate about. I'm grateful you asked me on the podcast.
Talking about gratitude, isn't today Thanksgiving Day in the US?
Today is Thanksgiving Day here in the US. That is true. A mixed bag of holiday, you know, so it's a historical day for us here. And there are many viewpoints for how to celebrate that. But, we're also in the middle of a pandemic. So I'm doing the thing of not seeing anybody, staying home, keeping to myself, because an orientation toward gratitude, part of that is that you are part of a community and you should be sensitive to your place in that. So just for me, the way I see it is how I take care of people is I don't go see them. So I'm sitting here doing everything remotely as I feel I should. And I think that's it's a great time to be talking to you across the world, right? That's another way to be, to put good out in the world, which I'm always grateful for people's interest in me and my work, and just for the chance to talk to your audience and to talk to you about this stuff that is great. But yes, today is Thanksgiving. It is Turkey Day for most of us here, if you eat that.
So we should, you started the show being grateful for the sunshine. I'm grateful for you and your perspective and staying home and, doing your part for the community. And we're, of course, grateful for you who are tuning in to listen to this. It won't be, obviously, Thanksgiving Day when you are listening to this, but I know that it was recorded on Friday in New Zealand, but Thursday, Thanksgiving Day in the United States.
Right.
But let's get started and dive into the first question.
Sure.
Amy, could you just take us back to where you first got into animal behavior, training, positive reinforcement, and we like stories.
I can't remember a time when I wasn't is the real answer. You know, I think that's true of a lot of people who work with animals. We don't quite choose it like one chooses, you know, accounting as a career or whatever, where you, you know, make a life plan, go to school, do the thing. Although certainly people do and you can. I didn't. I had always had animals. And part of having animals is training them, at least for most people, because animals don't just come pre-installed with every piece of software you need to live easily and nicely with them. So I was always into that. But I did formalize my education over time, and especially when positive methods came forward for us, that would be in the 90s, say mid-90s or so when I was first hearing about it, maybe late 90s. You know, that was a bit mind-blowing because that wasn't how the culture was talking about dogs and dealing with behavior change. And so I wanted to not just have just books and, you know, whatever mentor I happened to be around. I wanted to craft my education more. So I got formal education in positive dog training. And okay, once you open that, the world is your oyster. There are so many people to learn from. Even then, even before we had, you know, so much internet and so much online to be able to reach people who were not near us. But I mean, I went to every conference. I went to every seminar. I went to every school available to me because I was so hungry for this new way to train, this positive dog training as just a light bulb that was going off in me for, oh, these dogs are able to learn things I didn't know how to teach. And dogs are able to take information from what you positively reinforce. You don't need to be thinking about closing doors. You need to be thinking about opening the right ones. And it was intoxicating at the time. That was a long, long time ago. And it's hard to even remember all of the details then, because we're talking more than 30 years now when I really started. But somewhere along the way then, I know the date. It was 2006, but right there along the way, I decided to go back and get an advanced degree in this. I took a bunch of time. It was about 10 years, maybe a little less, maybe 8 years or so, and just halted everything and went to get a graduate degree in what turned out to be dogs. It was in the psychology department, but all of my material was dogs and the dog-human relationship and what domestication brought to dogs themselves, what that did to them living with us. And it was this wonderful time of just setting aside and delving strongly into what for me at the time was, oh, these questions I kept getting. Like people would say, I don't know, my dog is angry at me and that's why, you know, because I went away for the weekend and that's why he peed on my bed, right? And as trainers, we tell clients, well, you know, like that's probably not, you know, what's going on. Well, you know, it's probably more like this, and we'll offer a suggestion saying dogs are not really existing from, you know, in a place of spite or in a place of, you know, revenge, right? And we say that as trainers, but part of me in my brain was always like, well, how do I know that? What do we know about what dogs think and feel? What is the research on this? What is the reasonable evidence on which we are leaning? And so I was really grateful to be able to take the time in my life to go out and just go to source material, go to research, go to university, go to find out what we knew about what, so that when I talked to people afterward, and I had every intention of going back to being a practical dog trainer, it's my heart, I could say with more assurance what I really think we do know and what I think we don't know, rather than using lore and using just what we say. You know, I wanted to know, can dogs feel guilt? Can dogs be jealous? Can dogs act out of spite? Or when we say we don't think they can we lean on something real instead of, I just don't think so. That's just my experience. I didn't want to lean on just experience. So it was great to be able to go back. But while I was there, I was also exposed to things I wasn't planning on being exposed to. And that led me to developing other ways of interacting with dogs, which is the play way, which we'll get into, I know.
So what did you find out? How you said the question you went in with to university was, how do we know that? So we don't want to rest on lore, but how do we know that? And that's still a question I think about myself, because we have these conversations about labels all the time, and I'm like, you know, that comes up in my head. I'm like, but how do we know this? So after conclusion of your degree, which I'm assuming would have been roughly 2010, maybe started 2006. I don't know how long does it take.
They're really long degrees here. They're long degrees because you go in without the master's into the PhD program, and so it's a long program. I graduated in 2013. And for anyone doing the math, I went in my 40s, which is not a thing I recommend to people. It's just so much harder. Oh my God. Or maybe just for me. But I would love to have brought the energy of my 20s into something that rigorous. But yeah, I went in with, just a chance, you know, to put aside what is my normal life and really get to read source and see how it is that we know anything about animal behavior. And I was in a cognitive program, so it wasn't an ABA, it wasn't applied behavior analysis program. It was a cognitive a program with a cognitive bent. But that notwithstanding, you at the PhD level, you just read what you want to read. You formulate the questions and you tell them you're formulating these questions. They say, those are good questions. Now go find good answers. And you find everything there is to craft a good answer. And then you show the way you did that and what your answer is. And people go, that's good scholarship. Okay, run forward, right? So you're given your head. And you know, aside from what I studied personally in my dissertation, they also require you to pick three other sort of related topics and read an enormous amount of material on those too. And as I was doing that, I was getting a lot of exposure to human therapy models. I'm not a human therapist. I did not study human psychology, but I read, you know, enough to pique a lot of curiosity and get exposure to things I had not had exposure to before. I read a lot of child development. In fact, the PhD program I was in was in child development, and why they put me there instead of in more animal behavior departments was because when you ask questions of dogs, it's very similar to not only the questions we ask, but the way we ask the questions of children before they can talk. So if you want to ask a child, baby, say, ask if they have object permanence. And that would be, you see an object and then the object goes away and goes hidden. Does the infant have a mental representation? Do they know it's still there? Or do they think it disappeared off the earth, right? You can't ask them directly because they don't speak yet. And they can't give you answers. And that's similar to what we ask and the way we ask these questions of dogs. Do dogs have object permanence? Well, the methodology would be the same. So I was in a child development program because of method commonality. But being there got me to questions that I hadn't asked myself before, because dog training doesn't ask whether there's object permanence. I just need behavior change. I need the principles of behavior change, and that's what I use, right? So kind of turning my questions on the side a little bit was really fun. And getting to see child models was really fun informative and life-changing, because the way we get behavior change in people is more varied. And necessarily so, because humans are, you know, quite complicated, and there's a lot we, you know, get once we can talk back and forth. But how we deal with anxious children, how we deal with, you know, dysfunction in young children, was foreign to me. It's not the way we deal with dysfunction in dogs. And while I don't think they could ever be the same because of obviously very natural limitations there, it started me thinking. It got me on a different path to think, well, some of these things might be things I can pull from to work with dogs when I go back to doing that. Also, being in school allowed me to understand. I don't feel at all like I know the underpinnings I went there for. Like, I want to know if dogs feel guilt. I mean, actually, there is studies on that. But it wasn't like I went there, looked up answers, memorized them, and came out with answers. We don't know a lot of things. But I got to understand how we ask these questions and how much we should trust or lean on answers and which parts are speculative. And taking that into my trainer self, I feel like I can say, well, this is speculative but likely, so I'm going to go with this tack for changing their behavior, always knowing that if it isn't going the way I predict, I can change. It allows this kind of flexibility where you don't marry a thought. You don't say, well, I know now. I know that dogs feel this, so now I'm going to treat them this way, and I will close down my thoughts. It's like, no, it actually broadens so much, because you now have to say, well, there's some evidence that some of this is reasonable to assume that it could be true. So let's go along this path, always keeping an open mind in case something the dog says changes, you know, because the dog is the final arbiter there. So I liked being able to broaden the way I thought, but yet it gave me a sense of I don't need to know everything. What I need to know is how to be kind and how to change my approach based on what I see. If it's supposed to work this way, but the dog is telling me different, the dog is the one that's right, not the model and not the idea I thought I had. And I think that helped me be more flexible in that way. And as true, I lost track of your question, so perhaps I answered it and perhaps I didn't.
No, I find it so interesting. 2006, you said the psychology you studied was more cognitive psychology. Is it? Did I hear you right?
Yes, the program, or maybe I should say the bent, the orientation of the school of UC Berkeley is one of more cognition than of applied animal, you know, or applied behavior analysis. And that's more, you know, to delve into how those things are really different would be a really long conversation, one in which I'm not really qualified any longer to. I can't frame the debate. It's not even really a debate, but frame the two schools of thought so much anymore. But you know, we started psychology with the sense of not started, but at a point in psychology, we had a sense of I can't look in there, so I shouldn't be assuming you feel something or assuming I should look in the black box. And other researchers over time have said, well, I think I can do a little better than that. I think I can ask some questions that lead me to some answers about cognition. And Berkeley was one of the places that really focused on that. So the tone, the general material in front of me had a lot of focus on cognition and how and what animals think. Can animals time travel? Non-human animals. Can non-human animals, to tell time, plan for tomorrow? Can they understand things like grammar? You know, do they have a sense of grammar? Is there any grammar in what they do? Asking cognitive questions rather than just, and just is the wrong word, rather than focusing more solely on exactly how do they behave instead of focusing on ethology and on observable behavior, they broaden the question. I am not a cognition expert because I really pared down further from that. And then since I was in a child development program, I learned methodologies for asking cognitive questions like, do you trust information coming from one source over another? Do you understand shared attention? Do you look at what other beings are looking at and look at it yourself? Are you influenced by others that way? We use behavioral measures, but it's not solely asking how to get behavioral change through the forces of learning. It's asking maybe what's in your mind and then being cautious about interpretation of the results, of course, because you got to be cautious when you don't have someone telling you what they think and what they see, what they perceive. So yes, it was a cognitive program. I was in the child development side or section of things because the questions we ask children and the questions we ask dogs are really, really similar. And that yields great information. I mean, so much you know about dogs in the literature right now is from that material, like dog attachment, dog object permanence, dog problem solving. These come from questions we ask children because we need to know when children, we know adults have it. We know infants don't say have a certain thing. And at some point it comes online. So we like finding where that point is and how it happens. And right from there, you can just start applying it to dogs. So it was fun. I highly recommend people go, but I highly recommend they go earlier in life. That's my advice.
Well, yeah. It's fascinating to me because, and I am grateful for inviting people into my, what I'm going to label as my personal sphere of influence. But you know, because through Animal Training Academy, we run a community into that sphere of influence, our community being focused on applied behavior analysis. But that's a choice and totally knowing that we filter our learners' behavior through that chosen level of analysis and our own personal learning history. And that can alter our perceptions, our narratives, and our potentially our appreciation of what our animals are doing. So I'm grateful for why our animals are doing things. I'm grateful for learning how you see the world and how specifically the amount of reading that I'm taking away and that you've done, and I can appreciate that you have to do to earn the highest accolade of academia. So what do you have to share potentially with those? Because this is a question I get a lot. Where can I go to study? Like I want to get a tertiary education in behavior. It's a question I feel like I get. Yeah. I mean, people that orientate to Animal Training Academy are kind of seeking an ABA one. But I'm just curious about your thoughts. Like if someone was to say, hey, I want to start an academic journey to become a, you know, I want to stay as a dog trainer, but I just want to like become an academic as well.
Oh, I see. It's one of those tough questions to answer because I see these things as separate worlds is probably hyperbole, but I like to really make a sharp division in the way we talk about these things and apply these things and just really can think about them, animal training and animal behavior. I like having a space of time, a sphere, a conversation, a academic pursuit in things that may or may not bear out to matter in a day-to-day life of an animal and living with one and changing its behavior because I think that's great. I think we should be exploring things. If it yields nothing, well, it was not wasted time because even the act of exploration is worthy. But in my mind, I keep things very separate. It might indeed be that we discover that dogs can think in some XYZ way. We might find without a shadow of a doubt, which is not how science works at all anyway, but say we find without a shadow of a doubt that dogs for certain are jealous. And it's not something you can reduce to, you know, resource guarding or I want that thing, but have full-blown human-style jealousy, let's just say, right? Or pride, right? Like a lot of people think their dogs feel pride. I'm really proud of myself for having done this behavior, say. Well, I'm not sure I can say a dog feels pride. I don't think that's reasonable, but I think it's okay to talk about and to speculate and to go down the path of, well, if they did, what would that mean? And if they don't, where does that lead me? These are great conversations to have, and they're great to have academically. And it's fine. It's wonderful to set up some way to get at that answer with data. But I want to separate that out from what that means to me as a boots on the ground trainer, because often it means absolutely nothing. It's not going to change anything I do. And if it can have the influence of changing something I do for the worse, I want to be really guarded about that. I don't want to take any preliminary science on something. There's nothing in science that until it is a large body of work with many studies behind it, with lots of thought put behind it, that I'm going to lean on. I'm not going to lean on any one study of anything. I will take it in. I will listen. I will look at its methods. I will grant its premise and keep it up in the hot, keep it juggling. But it shouldn't change what I do if it's recent. And so I separate what we do with dogs entirely, which is, I think, a lot more what ABA, I don't want to speak for ABA, but I think a lot more where we lean on that sort of stuff. Because if I want to change behavior, I use basic behavioral principles that we know about and we agree on. These things are not at odds with each other. Just because you speculate about what might be going on inside doesn't mean it should change what you do with your hands, with an animal, when you are crafting a lesson for a learner. That's a separate place for us, I think. I pose to you and to all of us that if you want to be a really good animal trainer, there is no substitute for working with actual animals and lots and lots and lots of them. And before you do that, having a guiding principle that certainly guides you, that you cling to. You decide ahead of time what you will and won't do. You decide ahead of time what is ethical behavior, what is kind behavior to a learner, what is fair to put in front of them as a puzzle, what is fair to put in front of them as a consequence for how they behave, and what is your responsibility to keep these things, for me, kind and incredibly low stress, no stress, you know, challenge stress, but not distress. These are my guiding principles. And then from there, if I want behavior change, I'm, of course, leaning on the forces of behavior change. But I keep that separate from the idea that dogs might feel pride. And maybe indeed she does feel pride that she just got this right. But whether she does or only feels happiness or only feels some other word we would put there as a placeholder for happiness, like, I don't know, I enjoyed eating or something like that, or want to eat again, or show as evidence that I will eat again. Whether it's one of those things or the other is immaterial if I'm trying to get behavior change. As long as I can continue with my guiding principles that animals, that my learners are feeling no negative, they're not feeling stressed, they're not feeling upset, they're not, you know, I'm not making the situation worse by the choices, they're not being punished for things that they're doing. Then I can sit around and have a free time to speculate about pride and wonder if it's there and think it's there. But the second it starts to tell me, oh, well, she's feeling pride, so therefore I should now do this new thing, that's where I draw my line. I'm not going to change what I do based on something that we are exploring, something that might or might not be true, something that we put a pin in right now as a way to talk about it, but we might talk about it very differently 10 years from now. We talk about animal behavior very differently now than when I was a child or when I was young in college. We talk about it very differently. And so I think we need to be very flexible about that. If someone wants to be an academic, I think they need to separate their worlds and pursue what they find interesting academically, pursue what they find interesting intellectually. And yet, if you're going to want to apply that to literal animals in front of you, you're going to have to also have either a separate track or a parallel track or whatever that tells you how to use sound behavioral change principles and to use them kindly. So you need intellectual interest, you need a guiding ethical principle, and you need sound understanding of what it takes to change behavior and to do it kindly. And so this is how I see it, and it might not be, you know, the way everybody else sees it, but I don't think they're one cohesive whole. I think you have to think about them separately so that you can develop the skills and the ideas separately and not have them necessarily cross-pollinate. They may cross-pollinate, but you should do so cautiously and do so mindfully rather than, well, that's the way it is, so I'm just going to change what I do, or I'm not going to listen to the research. Neither of those is correct.
Cool. And I think the whole point of this podcast show is, it's becoming clear to me over the years, is that our guests don't always see things how everyone else sees them, and that's of significant value, and it's safe to talk about that. I value hearing all of that in your words. I think that was super valuable for us to add to our considerations as we have conversations with each other and with our clients. So when you were at UC Berkeley, what was the focus of your PhD? What happened after your PhD? And how did that lead up to what you're doing now?
I studied all sorts of things. I studied stress, studied the stress response in animals. I studied the role and function of oxytocin and social support formally. I studied what it means for people to have people around them, which right now actually means a whole lot. And I'm counting this as social contact, by the way. You and I were having a conversation, so I've had my social contact for the day. I studied touch and its relation to mental health. I studied the mental health of animals, Frank McMillan's work. I highly recommend anything he's written. Please go read him. But my dissertation was in whether dogs take information coming from somebody familiar as more reliable than information coming from someone unfamiliar. Is there an owner effect? Does it matter if I say the same thing as a stranger is saying? Will a dog trust my information more than a stranger's information? And indeed they do. And I put that in the framework of, it is evolutionarily advantageous for the dog as a species to go along with the one that has been providing for them. You know, if my dogs have been living with me and I tell them, hey, it's best if we do this thing, then the animal will be more successful in my family if they're sensitive to that, if they'll do those things that I indicate, even if in a specific moment it doesn't bring them the reinforcement that they were hoped that they, you know, that would keep that, that would maintain that behavior. I pose that it's in dogs' long-term survival to do that, to not listen equally to everybody, but to listen more preferentially to the information coming from familiars. That's going to make dog as a as a living in human life species more successful. Go with the ones that give you stuff, even if right now they didn't give you stuff. Long term, they tend to give you stuff. Long term, they watch out for you and they make you, you know, evolutionarily, they make breeding possible. They make, you know, your survival of your puppies possible. That's what, of course, evolution cares about. And so I wanted to see if dogs were sensitive to that. And so we pitted owners against strangers and had them giving dogs information and having dogs lose every time. Every time in one of my conditions, the owners, when they indicated where food was, you know, without getting to any graphics to which don't favor a podcast, but you know, there were two choices to make and owner was indicating one bucket where food could be and a stranger was indicating a different bucket where food could be. And I, in one condition, I had it be that the owner's information was always wrong and the stranger's information was always right. And dogs could find that out and everything. They could trial and error check that out. And still, they would prioritize going where the owner indicated, even though it never, or in some conditions, never or rarely got them anything. And I would find that they wouldn't really switch, at least not easily, readily, all of them, that kind of thing, which is, you know, it's a numbers game. Which really led me, you know, to thinking, like, of course, the long-term survival says go with what the owner says. You don't switch everything in the short term constantly. But that's my theoretical speculation. I obviously didn't prove anything to do with evolution, which is not how it works. But that's what I did there. And then when I left school, I knew I wasn't going to become an academic in the professional sense. I wanted to go back to dog training. I took a hiatus in life to go get a doctorate. And then I returned to what I do, which is help people help their dogs. I had been focusing on shy, fearful, anxious, stressed dog rehabilitations for a really long time. And as many of us, we get specialties because we get dogs like that. I had regular average dogs until I didn't. And then I had one that was really, 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 really scared. And so that shifted my professional interest, but well before grad school. But after grad school, I knew I was going to go back to being a dog trainer, but I didn't really have the playway already sorted out. That's a different story. That's something that happened because I started teaching at the Finzie Dog Sports Academy. So I don't know if that's what you want to transition to talking about now, or if you got something else. Okay. So I was dog training. I'm friends with Denise Finzie. We knew each other. We both got puppies at the same time, which was for me after grad school. I think this was, when did I get my dog? Don't remember. I'll figure out a year. We both got puppies at the same time. So we were seeing each other more often and training our puppies and socializing. Life brought me to where her house was, so we would hang out. And it was right about that time that she was starting the school. And she asked if I wanted to do a behavior class there. And it was just a few classes at a time at that point. It's a very big school now, but it was a beginning effort then. And I thought to myself, there is no way to teach behavior online. I was a little skeptical that I was going to be able to do that. I mean, in my experience, I want to see your dog. I want to see you. I want to see this. I want my hands on the situation. You know, I want the subtlety. I want to see the whale eye in your dog. I want to know that something's going to go wrong. I just didn't really think that online training was going to be it. And to be fair, it wasn't a very big thing yet. I mean, we weren't the first people, but it wasn't as big as it is now. And, so this is, I want to say 7 years ago, 8 years ago, something like that. And I started this behavior course, but I was now having a lot of time with Denise Finzie. I was having more time than we had had before. And I was getting really influenced by the way she framed certain things, the way she saw certain things, the choices she made, how she got herself to positive training and the assumptions therein. It was a different path than my own. So that yields a lot of like, well, how did you get here? Why do you have that question? How do you handle this thing? You know, both positive, but different frameworks and different ways of discussing, you know, because I have a pet training bent. I have a pet solution education. I've applied myself to pet problems my whole career. And Denise's was much more about solving sport problems. And of course, behavior that comes up there too, not just how do you teach healing? You know, it's a wide package, but still the people that come to her were different. And so she had different positive solutions than I had and different ways of framing how she thought of her answers. And it was just intoxicating to me to be exposed to some of that. And one of the things that was different for me was how she conceived of play. We don't do a lot of play in the pet market. There is some toy work. There is some, hey, if your dog likes toys, use toys as a reinforcer. But not a lot of delving into, oh, really good and really not so good ways to play with toys, just technique-wise. There are people out there that are not in the pet world that are so much better than those of us that are at the nuance, the real detail, the subtlety of toy play. And when I got into the sport world, I was like, oh my gosh, you guys know stuff I don't know anything about. So there was that. But there was also what she calls personal play. I call it social play, where it's just playing with animals without anything to help you. It's just goofing off and being ridiculous with animals. And she did it. I do it. People do it. We all do it with our puppies, right? But somehow it kind of falls by the wayside when it comes to doing it with adult dogs. And not only did she do it, but she did it in these characteristic ways. And she did it. She had thoughts about how to categorize the different moves she was using. Like, she'd given a lot of thought to play, and I'd given cursory thought to play at best, just something you do when you're socializing with your dog, but I didn't use it in any applied capacity at all. So that was bouncing around in my head, and it was adding to the work of Grisha Stewart at the time was coming up with BAT. And I was there in these kind of initial conversations where she was formulating her ideas and thinking about distances and thresholds and dog empowerment and how to put this in the hands of dogs and have it be less trainer controlled each piece, but more, if we have really big distances with huge honor threshold, can I allow things to unfold knowing they'll be safe? These are the questions I believe she was asking, or at least I take responsibility for characterizing it that way. She might use different description. And that was inspiring. I'm like, oh, right. We could be really thinking about threshold differently if we put ourselves to it. And what would happen if we did? Maybe nothing, maybe something. Let's explore it. And that was landing on my new information I had in my head about kids and how we do kid therapy. And it was all kind of amalgamating into some idea that I didn't really codify, but I wanted to explore. I wanted to see, because, you know, we play with children. We use play therapy with children. Everybody out there, go to theraplay.org. It's a child site. It's not about dogs. Theraplay, like therapy, but play.org. We use play to help children do things. And I didn't see anywhere where we were using play to help dogs. We were using tug and fetch, but I'm not talking about that kind of play. I'm not talking about reinforcement. I'm not talking about behavioral change reinforced with play. I was talking about something else, or thinking about something else. So we play with children to help them handle what they're feeling or to get feelings out. We play with children to get insight into things they can't explain. And I'm really interested in how we work with children who can't explain things, because I work with dogs who can't explain things, right? I work with animals who can't tell me what's really going on. I've got to just use what they look like and use what the choices were that they made. And the more information I have there, the better choices I can make for a dog. If they tell me earlier on that they're starting not to feel so great, I can make changes now. If I wait until I can see it really broadly, well, we've gone pretty far down the stress journey, and perhaps it's going to be really hard to dial it back and help them feel better. So, you know, I was looking for an earlier way to see, a way to interact with them that could maybe inform me and that might relax or help them feel a little better. And with no expectation that it would really do anything, and no assertion that that's what was happening, because I don't really know what is happening. I just know what I do, and I measure whether a dog is getting better, and the rest is speculation. But Denise's kind of play, which I took and ran with and explored, and Grisha's huge explorations in threshold and how to read it and how to stay way out of it so a dog is truly in a safe place, and double it again, you know, get even further and see if that helps any. Like, if it doesn't, well, there's no harm done in getting further away from what's upsetting to them, right? And you know, your explorations should be toward safety. Like, can I make it even more safe? And because then my risks are, well, if I didn't do it right, well, then I just didn't do any work, but they're still safe, right? I'd rather not explore things that push the boundaries of their safety, because then when I'm wrong, I could be putting them in very dicey situations. So ethical experimentation only. And I started just trying stuff in that online class. I took that class and I said, you know, try this. Take a flyer with me. Let's play with your dogs and play with them this way. And let's see if that helps at all. Oh, let's play with them this way and see if that helps at all. And I'll start playing with dogs here. And I just want to go on a play exploration and see what it helps me with in rehab. And then I was off and running because I loved what I saw. I loved what it gave me as a trainer. I loved the way it changed the relationships, the way people would talk about their dogs, the way their dogs would react with them, the enjoyment it seemed like I was seeing. And then from there, the stress reduction that I feel like I'm seeing as well, through measured through change in behavior, not I'm reading their mind, still using behavioral anchorings. But using play was getting me places that using my traditional methods, which would have been classical conditioning with food, and sometimes classical conditioning with the opportunity to play with toys, just wasn't getting me or wasn't getting me quickly enough. And so from there, I was off and running, and I've developed what we now call the playway. As a way to intersect with them, with a stressful animal, with an animal that's feeling fear, with an animal that's scared of something, to help them not be scared of that anymore and not find it stressful anymore. And that's what got me to the playway.
So have you answered the question, do you feel, about what playway is, or is...
I didn't.
And that's fine. Like, I didn't think you had either, but I was just conscious that you also did kind of.
I mean, I did. A little bit of an introduction. Right. I was telling you how I got there, but I certainly didn't tell you what it was. And, you know, because now they're separate answers. And also, I'm conscious of the time. I really can go on for a couple of hours. I hope your people are sitting down and have their coffee or their wine or their dessert.
Or just not. Some people tell me that they get home and they just kind of keep going and they drive around the block a couple of times.
Right. They can run during the podcast, but I have hours worth of, you know, this normally is a 2-day seminar for me. So I take 2 whole days to explain because I want to give so much more detail. But the short version for podcast reasons is that what I'm using play for, let's talk about what I'm not using play for. I'm not using it as reinforcement. I will parenthetically say I completely understand that that does not mean that it is not acting as reinforcement. I know that. I honor that. I get it. I know the procedure. I know how reinforcement is structured. But I am not, by saying I'm not intending it as reinforcement, I mean that I'm not putting it in the temporal relationship to make sure it is after a behavior that I want to see increase. So I don't put it in the framework of reinforcement. Does not mean that reinforcement is not happening. It's always happening somewhere. So it's not reinforcement. And it's not also either put in the place of classical conditioning. It is not done in temporal order with we play after the trigger shows up so that I can make a new association temporally. I don't do it there either. So that's why I see this as different. But that does not mean, again, the classical conditioning is not happening because you never escape classical conditioning. And I know that well, too. So the bleeding effects of classical, of course, are always around. So where do I use it? Well, so I want to tell you what it is, how we play with the dogs. And then I want to tell you where you put it to use in a setup. First of all, social play or therapeutic play, I also call it interchangeably, is a style of play that uses no food or toys. There's an exception to that. Some dogs are very mouthy. Some dogs are very young. So I might use a pacifier toy, but it's not about the toy. It's not about any food. It is about sociality. It is about us goofing around, being ridiculous, laughing with each other, and just being social for social sake. Dogs play with each other that way. You've all seen, or you have in your living rooms, dogs flopping around, play bowing, and then going upside down and playing patty cake and bitey bitey loose face silliness with other dogs, right? And they don't do that so much with us. And I teach people how to do that. I teach people how to play like a dog without having to have a toy in your hands, and without it being chase, big open games of chase. This is a living room activity where you play on your bed in the morning or at night before you go to sleep. These are kind of lazy, silly, and I'm looking for things like snorting in the dog. I'm looking for laughter. Go to my sites later if you want to see dog laughter. It's that that thing that they do, and it's not panting. I'm looking for... you can, your listeners can look for the literature on dog play when dogs play with each other, to look for things like taking turns, staying loose and bendy in your body. But I focus on helping people do that. And I focus on helping dogs interpret that as play from their people so that they can be snorty and laughy and silly and snorty again and loose-bodied and silly. And there's no toy to help you do it. It's just your enjoyment of each other. And when they can get that dynamic in, I teach them then how to use it. So that's the kind of the nuts and bolts of just the part of play, kind of how you do it. But there's, you want to see videos on this, but it just looks like people being ridiculous and low energy. I don't want a lot of arousal. I want lazy, silly, goofy, stupid, teasy, you know, that sort of tone. Then where do we put it? How do we use it? Well, I'll tell you that, that play like that, play in that style, if you hit it right, is very low value. It is not high value stuff. It is not the tennis ball. It is not the tug toy. It is not chase, which can be high value. It's not raucous, which is high energy, which could increase its value. It is low value. It is, it's the something that you do only when you're feeling great, and it could easily be usurped by something else on offer that is of high value. They would choose the high value thing over this silly play. And it's that by design. I want a very low value, low reinforcement value, interaction. And if I see as I'm coaching somebody that this behavior is getting really high in value and the dog is really super, super, super into it and starting to tune out the world and focus in on that thing you're doing, I change it because I want it to be very low value. Number one. And every trainer in the world is now saying, well, why? Because don't you want high value stuff to change behavior? But yes, I'm not changing behavior. I'm not putting this in a reinforcement package. I'm not putting it after a behavior and expecting the other behavior to now increase. It is not in the reinforcement model. Okay, so it's free to be low value. Then, because it's low value, a dog will not do it if there's anything in the way, if they can't. If they feel less than great, if they feel stressed by the situation around them, we start to lose our sense of humor, our repartee when we start to get stressed. Like if you're going to, give a speech and you're really nervous about it, you're not in the most relaxed frame of mind. You don't want to be, you're not going to be goofing around with your friend. You goof around when you're feeling pretty relaxed already anyway. Imperfect analogy, there's probably people who goof when they're stressed. But generally speaking, when we're tense and on and we're not able to be as lazy and as goofy and as silly and as teasy and as languid. So because you have that interaction with your dog, when they can't do it, they're telling you something. And that gives you as a trainer an early warning system to start shifting what's going on in your setup. Shifting where you are in the world. If you can play perfectly in your living room, but the second you go out to a park, your dog is like, I can eat, I could play, I could train, I can't do this silly thing. You can infer something from that. You can take information. It doesn't necessarily mean that your dog is petrified out there. You want all of the pieces, you know, to tell you that, but you're getting information. Because you've said, are you feeling as comfortable here as you feel at home? And they're saying, no, not really. No, I'm not exactly. I don't really. I'm more on guard out here. I have to watch stuff, say, maybe. So it gives you an early warning system when your dog can't play. And your dog choosing actively to play with you, but not responding to you making them play. Like I don't prod dogs into playing. I don't nag them until they finally play with me. I am available. I look ready, just like you look, say, for with toddlers when you want to play with them. You're like, hi, sweetie. Hello. You clap your hands. Hello. I'm ready. I'm interested in you. And the toddler goes, meh, no thanks. I'm going to go explore. They just do it without ceremony because they don't know about your feelings. So they just go do something else. Or if they want to come over to you, they just do. And so similarly in dogs, I want to be available to them and advertise that I'm available. And that's something you work at home explaining and making sure they understand that your overtures and your invitations mean you're available, but you don't insist that they play. And then you watch them make their decisions about their environment. So sometimes what they'll do, once you're at the place where you can use this in a setup, what'll happen is they'll, let's say you have a big empty field and they're a bit dog reactive. And so you place a helper dog very, very, very far across the field, right? You've checked your thresholds and all of this, and you put them way out there. What's going to happen is your dog's going to get there and at some point notice the dog and see the dog and then go, okay, I'm going to look at that dog for a while. And then they look at you and you go, hi. And they go, yeah, no, thanks, because I want to look at that dog some more. And you're like, all right, go ahead, keep looking. And what happens is they, if all things are set up, you know, ideally, they stop looking. They're done looking. They disengage from that. They dismiss the dog they were looking at because they're done now. And they look around and they sniff the ground and they look at you and you go, hello. And they go, huh, I think I'd like to start a game with you. And then they proactively start a game with you. They're the ones that start it. And if they can start it, you can then understand, take a guess that they're feeling safe where they are. They only play when they feel really safe to do so. And if they're playing in the presence of a dog way out there, they're telling you they don't have to monitor that dog so much anymore. I call that whole process look and dismiss, where they look around at stuff, they dismiss it, and they look back at you. My theoretical understanding of what's going on there, and this is speculation. This is not me asserting that these things are true at all. My speculation is that when you're scared of stuff, when you're scared of stuff that is not truly threatening, because we all should be scared of things that are threatening. That's reasonable. I'm scared of people who threaten me. But I shouldn't be scared of people who are safe and who are not threatening in any way. I shouldn't be scared of them because they are actually, in fact, objectively safe. But you can still be scared anyway. And if you are, if a dog is scared of, say, men, right? Men are not all their enemies. But a dog can be scared of them anyway, even when no threatening, overtly objective threatening behavior is happening. They're still scared because their reality is that they have identified this as a fearful situation, as a stressing situation. And I label that as misinformation. These dogs are laboring under miscalculation of what's really going on. I know that that man is not actually dangerous to the dog. The dog doesn't know that. Dog is telling through its behavior and its responses, nope, I'm scared of that thing. That thing is scary to me. I feel under threat. I don't think I'm safe. But I might know in reality that that man is actually not dangerous, right? So I'm labeling this a misunderstanding on the part of the dog. The dog doesn't have the same information I have. And so the fundamental problem is, how do I get them there, right? And we do that with classical conditioning. The man shows up, I make good things happen. You start to see that the man is a harbinger of good things. That's the classical model, right? So the way I think of it is, I think, dog, that you have not had enough chance to really look at who that person is and what they're doing. Oftentimes dogs look and they immediately go over threshold. And now they've already drawn the conclusion and they're already agitated and they're already scared. And they can't look for more than 2 seconds or 3 seconds without that coming up. So we give them a look and then we interrupt the look so that they don't get too scared by what they saw. I say if you, and I borrow this from Grisha, I say if you give them many, many more times the distance than that, so much distance, in fact, that they can look directly at the thing and not get agitated and not get scared. So how far away would I have to be, the analogy is, from a spider before I could look at it and not be scared of it? Don't like spiders, really don't. I'm very typical that way. And it essentially has to be pretty far before I can look at it and not get actually physiologically scared. So we asked the dog, how far away do you have to be to where you can openly look at this person and not feel threatened by their presence? How far? Football field? 2 football fields? I guess football is a different amount of space in different countries, but we all have football of some sort and the fields are big. So 2 football fields, maybe dog will say, yes, he can be 2 football fields away and I will not feel agitated by the fact that he exists. You're like, great, so let's start here. Can you look at him now? And the dog might say, yes, I can. And they'll look sometimes for a really long time. But as long as you can, through their bodies and their behavior, measure that they are not getting agitated, getting stressed, getting scared, getting stiff, you have the freedom to let them look. What play is doing in this scenario is keeping you honest as a trainer. Because if a dog can play, they're saying they're safe to be looking at these things because they're confirming for you their safety, their assessment of their safety. If they can play with you, they are relaxed. And when they look at the man that you've placed 2 football fields away or whatever it is, and then they look back at you and you're like, how you feeling? And they're like, you know, pretty good. Would you like to play? And you say, sure, I'd love to. They instigate the game. They'd like to play with you. And it often just kind of ramps up pretty slowly. They just look and then they loll and then they disengage from the man. They look at you and then they have an affection moment and then it morphs into play. It doesn't happen like right away as a marked thing that happens right when they look away. They're pretty relaxed and they have dismissed having to look at this man. And what we do is we just work these thresholds. We work the distances closer. And what we get is dogs who look kind of go, yeah, actually, I'm not particularly scared of that. That's not a threat to me. I have now information inside myself from having looked at this man for a long time or however long I needed to, that I don't think there's actually a threat here. Dogs who look briefly and immediately get a classical response, immediately have a big emotion, they're not open to new information or they're not easily going to get new information. You can give them cookies, but it's something you're going to have to be really aware of that they're under threshold enough that those cookies have some kind of power. So what I do is I just double those thresholds. I make them much bigger, much larger so that I can say, well, I'm not having to monitor it anymore now because I know you're safe in this entire scenario. Now, can you look at these people? Will you get new information if you do? I think you will. This was an idea. It was just an idea I had to see if it would work. It may not have been anything. It may not have been informative to them. But in what I'm seeing, I think it turns out to be very informative. They look for a long time, and then they kind of go, huh, all right, not really a problem, actually. I thought I had a problem. I thought this guy was scary because I was acting stressed and scared by his presence. But now I'm not stressed and scared by his presence. And in fact, I can not only take cookies or play tug, but I actually could play this low value thing that normally I would not engage in because it's so unimportant. I have used the early warning fragile, the early warning system of social play to confirm for me that the dog actually is not feeling stressed anymore, or at least measurably stressed anymore. Whereas food doesn't tell me low enough levels of stress. Dogs will eat food, many dogs will eat food when they're pretty stressed out. And it doesn't tell me as much information as I'd like to have about how they're responding stress-wise. But social play really does tell me, because it goes away the second the dog feels like, oh, I'm feeling a little bit like, I don't know about that guy over there. I'm not so sure. And then they turn to you and you go, would you like to? And they go, yeah, not really. And they lay down. You're like, oh, this is much harder for you than I thought it was. I'm sorry. Let's abort this one. Set up another one tomorrow or another day that's much further away so that you actually do feel safe enough to play here in the presence of what I see. And that's what a therapeutic setup would be like. And that's what I use play for. And I'm not going to say it's not reinforcing something or showing some classical effect, but I'm helping a trainer or the owner at that time divorce it from the model of you looked at me, you get something for that. Or you looked at the man, you get something for that. I'll play with you because you did a thing. Is the part that I have people not to do to keep their technique up. Is this making any sense to you? Do you feel like I've explained it?
I think
because I'm on autopilot.
The audience of the show are going to be curious.
Yeah.
In your words, you said even the act of exploration is worthy. I love that you said that earlier. And that's, I think, what these episodes are. They're little explorations into I was going to say the psyche, but I don't think that's accurate, into the work and psyche of our guests. And you've given that to us today. So to answer your question, yes, I think that's provided exactly what I was after. And I think large value for the listeners of this show.
Okay.
Some takeaways that I got. You want the play to be low value. You're using it as an information paired with lots of other information to make good decisions. And you're not asking your dogs to play there. They're initiating the play. So you sent me a great article, which I benefited from reading before the recording today. Can you tell me what that is, and is that the best place for people to go to learn more? I know there's a great collaboration you've done with Lily Chin in there as well.
Yeah, Lily, boy, isn't she a treasure?
I love her.
Oh, she's great. She's been here on your podcast, hasn't she?
Yeah, she designed one of my logos. She's designed a few of our logos, actually.
Oh, good.
And I know one of our members, Tessa Heron, is a case study in that article as well. Is that the best place to go for people to learn more? Or
it's certainly a quick and easy place to go to get a write-up. So I was the playway was written up in the Whole Dog Journal. If you go to Whole Dog, in fact, if you just Google Whole Dog Journal and Playway, the link will show up, the article. And they in their generosity, made that article the free article of the month so that you don't have to be a subscriber to that journal to be able to read this. And I was interviewed, I think, quite extensively for, you know, all of that. And it's got a lot of detail in it for just the stuff I said just now, but said in different words, maybe said a little more linearly because I, you know, because it's written. There's a graphic done by Lily Chin. And Lily was, she came to my last, I think it's my last seminar before all this hit. It was in January. Yeah. Gosh, is that true? And she was there. I didn't even know she was there. I didn't know she was going to be there. This is in Pasadena in her neck of the woods and in California. And she was taking notes as she does with drawings. And she was drawing the way dogs play and drawing the way I was trying to inspire dogs to play and drawing my body language. I teach people in the Playway seminars how to be a better player, how to be a good partner in play. So it means dialing down your intimidation factor. It means taking away your monkey self and putting your hands on the ground because dogs don't use their hands to play as much as you think they do. We just bat around at dogs and dogs are like, I'm playing with a monkey. I'd rather play with the dog. So I teach them how to do that. And she was taking these graphic notes, which was wonderful. And then so she drew this infographic, which is, it's marvelous. It's a great way to start to see what we're talking about for social play and how to read your dog's enjoyment of it. And so you read the article, and the article will, you know, highlight how to use this, what I'm really thinking of it as being used for, how the Playway keeps a trainer honest. You know, we can lie to ourselves about threshold because it's just in good, you know, in you know, not on purpose, you know, what is that? I mean, with good intention, get over threshold for dogs. And if a dog doesn't tell you they're over threshold, if their behavior, their gross behavior looks what you think is okay, yet they could be hiding some stress under there. Well, the play keeps you honest because it'll keep you really confirming that you're under threshold and can actually do this work. And there's no reason why people can't blend this stuff because you could confirm through play that you're under threshold. And then you could then switch to, I'll give you cookies every time you look, if that's what you'd like to try to do. The play tells you if he's feeling okay. From there, you can make your decisions. You don't have to have play be the sole therapy you do at all. It's a tool. But I ask people to explore the idea that you don't have to drive what they learn. You don't have to tell them. You have to set the stage so that what they're learning is going to be safe. You have to make everything in their environment safe, but you can then turn it loose so that they can learn. As long as you've shown that everything around will result in them learning positive things, you do or don't have to then provide from your hand the positive thing that you want them to see. So that's what Lily was trying to draw and what we were trying to say. But for in-depth stuff, that's a great place to just get like a summary and a what is this? Because I don't have the book that's out yet. It is still in process and books are much bigger projects than I ever envisioned that they ever were going to be when I embarked on that project. Oh my gosh. Publishers out there, someone hit me up. But I also run this as a class at the Finzi Dog Sports Academy. So people who want to delve into learning actually how to learn this, how to become really good players, how to apply it to solve any number of different dog problems, and not all of them. I only apply it to certain ones. I don't apply it to, say, guarding. I don't apply it to owner-directed aggression, right? You can join my class at the Finzi Dog Sports Academy, and that's it's actually running right now. It hasn't started yet. It's going to start December 1st, but I guess by the time you're listening to this, it has just started. But enrollment will be up until the 15th. And I run that class every other term. So every term is 2 months. So I run this class every 4 months throughout the year, all year long. And we have just many of accessible levels. There's from getting daily coaching from me to just watching to being on scholarship. So it's not necessarily an expensive endeavor at all. And you'd get 6 weeks worth of my speculations about what's going on with the dogs in front of me and how to play more sensitively with this animal, how to get a dog whose only gear is 0 to 60 and they play like gangbusters. How to get that dog to slow down and play lazily is different from the journey of how to get a dog who's like, I don't know. I don't think I'm safe. I don't want to do this. I was told not to use my mouth with people, and I think I'll just stand here and wait to do what I'm told. Playing with that dog is different. And so we go down all these journeys there. And so if you want to go for an in-depth, there's that. But certainly start with the Whole Dog Journal article, and anyone out there is free to contact me and say, you know, where can I learn more about what you're doing? Or, you know, is this right for me? Or I want to explore this. Is your class right for me? Please definitely contact me. You can, you know, on Facebook. And I also have Facebook pages. People can go there to see the Playway, the Facebook Playway page has videos of me doing all kinds of ridiculous play stuff with my dogs, and my students submit videos there, and I do lives there, and I talk to all comers. I'll talk to anybody who wants to talk to me about this kind of stuff and exploring what play can do. And I'm really excited about a lot is putting it in the hands of people who then can say, like, you know, Denise put just play in general in my hands. She just plays this way, and she thinks about predator style play versus prey style play and how that unlocks different things in dogs. And I'm like, oh my God, I've never heard of these things. Right. And I took it and ran with it to combine it with the things I knew and was being influenced by. So I'm really excited about the idea that someone could see some of this stuff and combine it with something they know that I don't and take it in a completely different direction. That would be just super exciting. So, you know, I want to talk to people who are excited about play, and, I'm super accessible out there on the internet, especially now, right? Because you know, I'm grateful for anybody who wants to come talk to me about this sort of stuff. And that's mostly how you find me. I'm prolific. I'm not a prolific blogger. That's not my thing. I'm trying, but I do like to do lives. I do like to do Facebook lives. I like to do podcasts, and that's how you would find me. And on my website as well, which I'm sure is in your written material, probably.
When the words of Amy Cook, the act of exploration is worthy. Ethical experimentation only, she says.
Ethical experimentation only. Ethical. If you don't have a guiding principle for how you're going to do things with dogs, I don't know how you're sorting out techniques, because there's plenty of techniques that could be in a quadrant you think is okay to use that your learner will say, I'm not feeling very great about. If you don't have, your first and foremost should be, I have an ethical guideline that says I will or won't do certain things. And when I'm exploring play, I'm not the one in the spotlight. Learner is. Learner has to tell me they feel great about this. And if I can't tell that a dog doesn't like something, that's where I start. And then if a dog tells me they don't like what I've done, even if I think it's perfectly kind, well, they win. They tell me it's not kind. Anything you're going to ask of your dog, check first. Could I do this with a toddler and they wouldn't cry? You know, I mean, it's not a perfect rubric because we don't tug with toddlers, but you know, we have to be kind and be fair and be empathetic and be, you know, really aware of what a learner's experiencing as best we can. Cast our mind constantly to what may be a learner's experiencing here, so I could be even more kind in the way I'm asking it. And then after that, I can say, well, I could ask something this way, or train it this way or this way, because they're both equally kind. Now I can see which one the dog takes most meaning out of. But if I'm not first saying I have to be kind to you, I think there's a problem. I think that should be guiding us more than a quadrant analysis, although a quadrant analysis is correct to do, so you know what you're doing and getting behavior change. It is not where I start. I start with, how are you feeling about this? Are you okay with the fact that you're even in school? Because perhaps I can't do any positive reinforcement with you because you don't even feel safe, you know, safe here, right? So kindness first, and then we explore.
Wonderful. And we're going to, of course, link to everything you shared in that last little segment with us in the show notes for this podcast. But I think for today, we'll wrap up the episode there. We'll leave the space open for the listener's curiosity to go and explore those resources that we shared with you. Even if you don't use it, as Amy says, the act of exploration is worthy. Nothing can be lost from going and checking it out. Amy, this has been a ton of fun today. I've really enjoyed connecting and learning and talking with you. So from myself and on behalf of everyone listening today, we really appreciate you taking the time to come and hang out with us. Thank you so much.
It was such a pleasure. And, you know, it always feels too short when it ends, because I want to go on and on and on forever. So thank you so much for giving me this space to kind of talk about what I'm passionate about. I would love to hear from your listeners at any point, anytime. Just hit me up, and just grateful to spend this time of day doing this with you. I really enjoyed myself. Thank you so much.
It's a good day to be grateful.
Indeed.
We do, of course, really appreciate all of you tuning in today as well. And if you have enjoyed this episode and you were interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnest, choice-rich ways, then as mentioned at the start of this episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior geeks. That's it for this episode though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much everyone for listening. You'll hear from us again soon.